Welcome to this week's Podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
The Podcast with a K, with Christian Colley, James McLean, and Brian Terranova.
Okay, hey, welcome everyone to this week's Podcast with a K. Today, Christian cannot join us, but you have James. Hi, James.
Hello.
And myself. We're going to be doing another podcast with a commentary. I had to put the accent there because that's with a K, in case you couldn't tell the way I said it. You really should be able to tell the way I said it, though, right, James? I
mean, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's obvious, right?
Absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely. Great. I thought so. Today, we're going back to the 60s. We're going back to Dr. Number One, William Hartnell, with the Space Museum. Nice four-part story for everyone to enjoy. A good four-part story, although maybe I should save that for the commentary, right?
You might find you change your mind through it.
I might, actually. This is true. I might find some things in there where I'm like, did I say this was good? What was I thinking?
Absolutely. That's the whole exciting, sexy thing about these things. Sometimes things change. Not often, but sometimes. Right, so shall we get this rolling? We'll do a countdown. We're hoping we'll have hopefully be able to hear it in the background as we're playing. And we're doing that intentionally again to give you markers as to where we are. So if you are listening to this in the car, you know the story, which we assume you do to be listening to this. You'll get a feeling of where we are, which is the idea. Okay, so shall we do this in 3, 2, 1 now? Right, so we're also going to cheat a little as usual and pretend that we're better than we actually are, and we're going to be running the info track to the DVD, which just gives us little hints. And to us it's like having a producer who's whispering in our ear facts that we've not bothered to learn. So that's the idea. So as it says, yes, this is sort of 1965 time. This is getting to near the end of the Ian Chesterton Barbara Wright era. I have to say, you know, we open up on that rotor shot, and it is such a wonderful design, that really, of the whole thing. That is a really good bit of design.
Yes, yeah, the whole first console room set, and I know like one or two of the walls were just like painted roundels, but the whole first console room set is gorgeous. That ceiling light above the console,
mm-hmm. Yes,
that's incredible. That, you know, alone, but all the intricate little details within the time rotor of that console is just gorgeous. I mean, they've done cool ones since, but I don't think they've ever done one quite as detailed.
I see something that people never tend to notice, and here we have that. That's the scaled prop, isn't it? That the TARDIS materialization originally was the same as the dematerialization.
Yeah. Well, and there were even episodes too where there was no sound.
Yeah, absolutely. Early ones especially. But I going back to that rotor, which I know we shouldn't because we're getting away with the story. But what I like about it is that while the rest of the console does have a certain 60s feel, you've got dials and meters and switches, that interior section is quite alien.
Yeah. Sorry, I was stuck there reading some of the show notes. Oh, man. they're quite distracting, but
yes,
hey,
they
good
can
stuff.
Be. So try not to look at them because, you know, we can do this. Or the backdrop at the background, the cloth one.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the pilot. Do you remember the pilot with its long cloth one that just sort of folded up at the bottom on the floor?
Fantastic. I also like how they had the set kind of dressed. Like, look at that piece behind the doctor there.
Yeah.
You know, they had all sorts of stuff like that around there. And I've heard people say, like, with the Eighth Doctor's TARDIS, that it was too, like, he had lived there. You know, whereas the Doctor, he doesn't live there. He doesn't live anywhere. He just goes everywhere. And I'm like, well, no. The TARDIS is his home. He's mentioned that many times. You know, like, I think this is fine. I like the set dressing. Like, this is this man's home. So dressing it up is great. You lose that later in the 80s.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the 80s...
Well, the 70s even, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You'd lose it pretty much after Troughton, really.
Yeah.
Just, you know, a couple of chairs, which just feel like left over from the prop sets. Oh, there's the gigantic
That's
wardrobe.
It's a great, like how early on this is, and I know we're into Vicky rather than Susan here, so it's still a little bit further along But how much of this TARDIS we get to see?
Yeah.
You know, like that stuff didn't really even happen in the new series till when? Like Tennant's Christmas episode, the first Christmas episode, they gave us a CGI rendering of what a wardrobe was, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and then we didn't really get to see much more of the TARDIS until, was it Smith's era?
I mean, I'd like to have actually gone back and seen this firsthand, because, I mean, we obviously now live in a world where continuity has been established over time.
Sure.
And there's nothing in these early episodes which suggests the TARDIS is infinite or absolutely massive. I don't recall anything being said at all until, like, sort of Mask of Mandragora, really, that sort of suggested that there was any massive scope to it. You get these rooms off the main control room, but there's no... I don't recall anything that suggests an infinite space as we establish it now, or, you know, a near infinite space.
No, the first time I remember an infinite kind of space being mentioned was the Fourth Doctor's era.
Yeah. So, I mean, here, it's like a bigger time ship in the inside than it is on the outside, but yeah, as you say, you get this feeling of living space, but you don't get this feeling of ridiculous space.
Yeah, no, I think what's great about it is that, you know, the TARDIS essentially was originally just, you know, bigger on the inside was good enough, I guess. Yes. You know, that was the magic enough. Yeah, that, like, this thing that should be like 4 foot square, if I'm not mistaken, is the original box is a 4 foot square, 4.5 foot square on the inside. Is like the size of a small home, essentially, is what we're seeing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's perfect to me. I don't really think it needs to be more. Like, having an infinite space inside a TARDIS does seem kind of ridiculous for Time Lords, considering, you know, what we learn of them later is that they never go anywhere. They never do anything. Instead, they just police time from their own home, you know, and then only people like the Doctor took the TARDIS to leave, or they use them for just special missions or whatever. It's like, do you really need to put an infinite army inside there? Like, yeah, we've never really seen the need for that, you know?
I mean, I've always seen it as, in my faith, how I've always looked at it as, is the TARDIS has obviously, I've never gone with infinite life. I think it's got it has the potential for maximized space.
Sure.
In the sense that at this point, I could imagine the TARDIS actually being quite small. It being, as he starts playing around with it, and he gets bored, he reconfigures and expands it. But there's no reason, as you say, that Time Lords would have.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. This right here, I've always loved this moment with Ian, like, bumping his fists together like that.
Yeah.
Every time I've watched this story, I love the fact that he did that. He put that continuity between him walking out from the TARDIS set to the actual planet set, and remembered what he was doing, so that there was that continuity, kind of like what you got in the first episode, Rose, when we could finally see, first episode of the new series, Rose, when we could finally see straight into the TARDIS. Well, I guess we've seen that before in the classic series too, but I just love that continuity that he thought, like, okay, I'm going to do this thing where, I don't know if it was his idea or whose, but
I bet it was his.
It just shows straight through. Yeah, that was really great. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your thought, but, you know, it was the thing that was on screen.
I just noticed, I love it. That wasn't the scaled model. That was actually the full-scale prop earlier as well. I was wrong there.
It's amazing because it really did look like the scale model. But I mean, like, that's how those things can look when you have a backdrop like this making things look like a model too. You know?
Well, it's changed a lot by this point. It's starting to move into its Troughton era. It's not quite there yet, but you start those sort of significant... contrast in the whiteness and the badges, everything's all going now, the top lamp has changed, you know. Yeah. I know these again, we're going into props. Maybe we should talk a little about the Space Museum itself. I mean, this first episode is, I think, what people generally agree is what makes the Space Museum is this first episode, and the rest doesn't quite live up to its potential.
Well, the premise is what's so brilliant about this story, you know, and it, you know, it is... It is, in fact, like one of the few stories of like this era that maybe that isn't even true, but it's one of those great stories that doesn't revolve around an alien invasion that they've just walked into. There's an alien conflict here, but it's not an alien invasion that they have to stop. It's more so that they have their own lives at danger due to you know, a trip up with the TARDIS, you know, which is pretty brilliant. No, this one isn't even a trip up with the TARDIS. Which one is this? Well, I guess we'll find out. All of a sudden, I can't remember because I'm thinking of The Edge of Destruction as the trip up with the TARDIS.
But there is a trip, isn't there, essentially? I mean, this is a...
Well, of course, yeah.
That's a... not quite got the accuracy between model to stage doorways, but good try. It's it to me it does feel more like a later Hartnell. This it doesn't feel like a Chesterton and Barbara story. I mean, even though, yeah, as you say, it's got sort of harks back to certain time things like Edge of Destruction.
Yeah.
It has that sort of slightly, as we said, you know, the third, next three parts don't carry the same weight as the first one. It has that sort of slight shallowness, I think, sort of starts to sometimes flip through in his later stuff. Maybe that's just me.
Well, no, I mean, the Doctor started to mellow. With
yes,
them, started to not. It wasn't all of a sudden all about him, you know. Especially as a matter of fact, I think a lot of that really changed pretty heavily when Susan left.
Yes, I think so. I think also, obviously, the deviation largely away from decent historicals.
Yeah.
Marks a feeling of his later era, and not so much this era. So I think that possibly is part of it.
I also really like, you know, just going down to basics here, I really love the costume design for Ian. I've always liked how they dressed him. And I know that was the era,
yes.
You know, but he always looks so good in these things. This outfit right here is great. And not that I can imagine wearing a turtleneck today, but for whatever reason, it looks fantastic on him. You know?
I wish I'd like to wear a turtleneck. I always like the turtleneck Keaton wears in Batman. I just thought that that worked.
And his jacket looks almost Beatles-ish here. You know, like something of their era. I mean, obviously it is their era, but something like that they wore in this time.
However, Barbara has decided to go for the matron look in a hospital.
I'm not quite sure what she's
wearing. It's a terrible outfit.
I've always just put it down to school teacher, but you're so right. That is such like a, like, I guess what we would have said, a nurse thing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, matron is pretty old fashioned for us as well, but sure. Yes, it's... I know we've said this 1,000 times, but it is just a reminder that when you get older actors, you get so more, in my opinion, you get so much more range played on even simple scripts like this.
Yeah.
There's so much confidence in William Russell. You know, even here, where he's looking and the way he's acting and responding, he's just doing reactions to the area and to the lead speaker at the time.
Yes.
And they are not fixed. He's thinking, he's reacting to it. And you don't get many actors to do that. Maureen O'Brien, bless her, isn't really doing it. Not to the same way. She, to a little bit, but it doesn't look quite as natural to me. And I think that's just age, not skill. It's just, you know, experience.
No, absolutely. I agree. And it's more so, you know, someone who realizes living that character rather than just doing the scene, you know. Which is a huge difference. Plus, also, I think part of it, I wonder, I mean, I'm sure it's there in films today as well with seasoned actors, but part of it may also come from how long the takes are, you know, and just like actually you get time to actually breathe as an actor and be in the moment.
That was a nice little bit there as well, which I imagine was probably directed more than anything, where they all see the Dalek and it's Vicky doesn't react to it because Vicky, for some unknown reason, has never seen a Dalek before.
I've always kind of liked that about the original series, though, is that, you know, the Daleks' continuity was never that they were like they were everywhere, you know, like it was they started to expand since the Doctor found them. So this is like a good bit of actual continuity here. But if time is really screwed up, as time really is in the new series and even later on in the original series, then Daleks would be everywhere, you know.
Well,
but that's one thing about this show that's great is, in my mind, a lot of people always say, oh, the Time War. But I don't see that. I see that time is just constantly in flux. The more the Doctor and the Master and other people are out there and the Daleks are screwing with time, then these stories, like this particular one that we're looking at, Vicky doesn't have any idea who the Daleks are, but maybe in one version of time later, like say during the Fourth Doctor's era, there's a version of Vicky out there who's very much aware of what the Daleks are at this point in her life.
Or I could counter that and say, I understand the catch-all issue of the Time War, but the Time War does create some very interesting retrospective ideas in the sense that you could say the reason Vicky does not remember is because of something within the Time War that has retroactively affected other people's continuity. So this character at this moment is affected by some time stream in the future that obviously the Doctor would be oblivious of as well. But I agree with you. I think the point is, if the more you consider everything is in flux, the more you can just let things go, which is nice and not have to point to any particular.
And I think to me, I think the idea of everything being in flux is more helpful, more interesting, just because that's just something that's happening that's out of these characters' control. And technically, the Time War is out of their control, too. And I don't want to say that there aren't ripples from the Time War, because I do believe that there are. And I think that is still a cool thought. I think the two, both of them, can be at play here.
Oh, yes, definitely.
The only one that I don't want to believe is at play is Clara. And because, you know, it's that. Just because that.
Well, but hey, it's one of the things. I mean, one thing I always found with Davis's era, which upset me, was that I felt that by rooting it on Earth, you sort of got this feeling. We've said this before. Obviously, we've done podcasts for too many years now. You know, that it constricts the world, that everything starts to become localized rather than broad. And as soon as you have something like Clara, you've got the same sort of thing. As soon as Clara is affecting the whole of his timeline, everything constricts again. Nothing feels expansive. And, you know, science fiction is often, well, not fantasy anyway, not science fiction necessarily, is escapism. So you want to think of broad rather than narrowed. And Clara narrows things. And well, the universe being in flux, time being in flux, and people who say, well, the time laws were controlling everything at this point, while later they weren't. They weren't totally, because there was stuff obviously going on that wasn't out of their control that they'd have to sometimes pocket the Doctor to deal with, or even have calamities themselves, like in the Three Doctors. So there is definitely a natural flux. And the other thing I like about that idea is that you have this early ones where Hartnell's Doctor saying you can't change anything. You look back at it and it starts to make him look like a very young Time Lord who doesn't actually understand time that well.
Yeah.
You know, there are obviously, as has been established at the moment, areas that you can't change. Sort of nexus points, which is probably what he thought everything was like, or more, there were more of, but he's not as educated as he sounds, which is kind of fun as well.
Well, there's two thoughts there. I like that like he just thinks that they're all kind of like what has become known as a fixed point.
Yes.
You know, but the other aspect of it too is that I always felt that some people took that too literal, you know, where he says you can't change time, not one line. I never really took that as, you know, no matter what you do, you can't change time. I took that as we're here to observe. We're not allowed to change. We're not supposed to change. So you can't do that. Like, that's just wrong. It's like a rule. Like, yes, physically you could go take that brick and break that window, but you shouldn't take that brick and break that window is how I always kind of took it more so. Like, he's aware that they can leave footprints through time. So the least amount of footprints that you leave, the better, kind of thing. But there's, I like both aspects of that, because I do like the fact that he is still, especially since we see him not able to control the TARDIS, it does make it seem like he isn't as educated as we give him credit for. We're kind of a little bit just past the scene there, but the scene where Vicky had found that one item in the museum that she could pass through, and now they're starting to realize something is afoot here, and that's one of the things that always just got me about the story. Oh, and of course here we are now, they found the TARDIS, for those of you not watching with us, which is, I love this, like here's their own ship in the museum, here's the TARDIS, as a Doctor Who viewer of the first time, seeing that they just got out of this thing and here it's in the museum and they can like pass through objects in this place, it's trippy. It's almost Twilight Zone-y.
Yes,
this story.
It is. It's very British, isn't it? It's very... I have to go back to Ian's outfit. I really like it, because it does have... While it has got 60s elements to it, it's so smart. It's sort of almost timeless.
Yes, yes. You could absolutely wear that today.
Yeah.
I mean, that jacket certainly is a great jacket.
But that's it, because there's nothing in it that is... styled to a time per se. Everything sort of it fits his figure, the jacket's well tailored,
right?
Polo necks, yes, aren't as fashionable now, but as an item they're not silly, they've got a certain style to themselves, so.
Right, some people still do them, they're a very specific look, but I mean that jacket could look good with any kind of shirt underneath.
I thought that sort of thing would have done very well for Capaldi, actually.
Oh yeah, actually, I could see that. And that would be nice and different rather than another, like, three-quarter length coat that we've been
absolutely
used to, you know?
Yeah.
This, the great reveal. They're all in the showcase in the museum, all four of them. That's amazing.
Absolutely. It's a great twist, as I say, never quite gets played to at its best, but it still makes a great setup for a story.
Well, what's great about this, too, is it goes right back to what you and I were saying with you can't change time, not one line. But here, their whole goal is to change time, to make sure that these don't happen. And they do have that issue of everything that we're going to do may be exactly what we did before to try and avoid getting in those booths, to send us to those booths. So if we're going to turn left here and you want me to turn right because maybe turning left gets us in the booth, well, how do we know we didn't already think of that? And turning right puts us in these booths as well. And it's such a great idea because you really have no idea what you should do. The only thing you can do is react to every situation and hope you don't end there.
Yeah.
So while you're right, while it never really truly like is as tremendous as this resolve, it's still absolutely brilliant to me because they're just stuck in that situation of, I want to help, I want to do the good things that we usually do, and if that means we're going to end up in these cabinets, well then, I guess that's what's going to happen.
I think this story would have benefited from an Edge of Destruction approach and just being two episodes which really focused on this problem rather than the sort of dilemma, the social dilemma, which plays out in the next three episodes.
Yep, maybe so, that's a good point. Although I do have to admit, I really do like getting, I mean, it's one of the things we always talk about the classic series. I enjoy getting a look at this world,
seeing
what this is about.
I do like that. But at the same time, maybe it's a preciousness. But with these four characters, they can work with such minimum guest stars.
Absolutely.
Maureen and Carol are the same. Yeah. So in a sense, this could have been a very spooky two episodes if it was largely just the four of them.
I don't know if this is controversial or not, but my preference between Vicky and Susan is actually for Vicky.
Yeah, it's a little controversial, but
yeah,
there's not a horrendous amount of difference between the two of them, so can't.
No, she was definitely she definitely wasn't created to be that different, but I don't know. I think there's just something about her. Maybe it's the way she's acting the character that I take to more. But nothing has happened to us yet. What we are doing. Don't know.
Yes.
But you're right. I mean, she was brought in to fill that granddaughter role for him. But I like the way that they played that too, because I like the fact that they didn't just make it be like, oh, Susan changed, you know, or like here's another actress to play Susan. Like they brought it in and he basically adopted her on screen, which I thought was great.
Yeah, I mean, Carol Going sort of gave them a sort of a format for the series. It gave them a direction for the series that the series could exist outside the characters, to the point, I think, which is probably in a sense Carol spelled the doom for Hartnell, because as soon as you start having your companions realizing they can move on and another person can replace them, your show starts thinking, well, maybe we can do that to the lead character as well in a weird way. Maybe we can replace that actor. And essentially, the fact that actors could move on from this serial, and it took us almost like a soap perspective, a soap drama format, it allowed the show to perpetuate. So this, you know, before Susan decided to go, you've got a question of, if you're imagining this show like most other shows that don't change their characters, like, say, Star Trek, for instance, where, you know, the roles were set for 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, this is it becomes quite a different idea. So, yeah, have them leaving set the paving for the whole show, and perhaps more than the actual concept. This is nice as well.
It's an interesting montage. Rather than using like actual footage, they use stills from it for that. But it's an interesting choice.
See, that badge is almost is almost gone now, and the windows are losing their whiteness.
I like that. I like that essentially time is just catching up with them, that kind of feeling, rather than just like in a blink of an eye, things are changing. I like that. I like that concept of it. And that they're all frozen again, like we saw them in the beginning. It's great. It's great, too, that it's also kind of not fully explained as to why they're like frozen or anything like that. I don't feel that we need to be force fed explanations for everything. Like, I'll tell you what, I saw this article the other day. Someone explaining, one of the Doctor Who writers, and I can't remember what it was, or maybe it was one of the Marvel films, but I think it was a Doctor Who episode. One of the writers was explaining, this is what happened in the episode. And all I thought was, if you as a writer have to write an article or do an interview where you explain to the audience what happened in your script, then no offense, but you didn't do a good job writing your script, you know, or filming it, directing it, acting it, whatever. Like, excuse me, we have to be able to walk away from it, understanding everything. But then again, not everything needs an explanation. Like here, all we needed to know was that something in time tripped up and they're screwed up. They're out of sync with time. And now time is catching up with them and they have to stop that future that they saw from happening. That's enough. I don't need to know exactly why that happened. You know, like I think sometimes they think they're being too clever and it's just not good, but it worked great here.
Right. We're going to hold off now and we're going to take a little break, but obviously you'll barely notice it. It'll be a split second. And we'll be coming back with part two. Stop your recording for a second. We've stopped ours. We're about to go back in. We had to take a little break just to check recording levels and I needed a hot chocolate. We're about to go back into episode two of the Space Museum. So we're going to synchronize 3, 2, 1, episode 2. There we go. It's nice to get back to this. We've just been having a horribly long conversation of some of the horrible things going on in both our countries at the moment. So it's nice to get back to Doctor Who and escape all that.
Yeah. What I've always said about film and TV, you know, when people want to make it so ultra realistic today is, does nobody remember when it was escapism? When it was an escape from reality, an escape from the daily BS of life. And here we are, escaping, just as the Doctor and companions are trying to escape their fate.
I still think, you know, that old Life on Mars idea of, I can say that now because it's an old show, theoretically.
Yes. 10 years.
You know, worlds existing in an afterlife, in a sort of purgatory or limbo, where moral judgments are exercised in quite sort of simplistic fashions, is the ultimate essence of television, this sort of escapism television, because it is all built essentially around moralities. So you could imagine this sort of being sort of like an afterworld sort of for us beyond, where we would end up in places like this, where everything's a lot more simplistic, not quite as many people, down to simplistic components with moral dilemmas of who's bad, who's good, who needs redemption, who needs to be punished. And that's life, or afterlife.
That's crazy. I like it, though.
I love it. And, you know, Life of Mine, after watching that, I was watching, you know, soaps and thinking, you know, soaps are just like that. You know, it's just like an afterlife. Sorting out your judgment, sorting out your sins. What sins have these people done in their past life? Anyway, so yes, at the moment we're now suddenly for the first time in story actually getting introduced to other characters, which is possibly one of the only stories I can think of in Doctor Who, bar the Daleks episode one. And I suppose episode one of An Earthly Child, where the first episode is entirely main cast.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a couple people in, actually, I guess there's a bit of a difference with this one, where there were a couple of people within the first episode of the Space Museum, but they were just kind of, I don't want to say set dressing, but they were just kind of there.
Yeah, there's no talking parts.
It added a different feel to that kind of just main cast situation.
So, yes, it's quite an unusual story, especially so late on from those early ones to take this approach.
You know, in essence, though, it's kind of like maybe one of the series' first, if you will, three-parters. Because the main kind of, well, not the main, but the main story for these characters, these aliens, is a three-part story.
You could almost argue that the first part, if we take it into sort of New Who, would be the teaser.
Sure.
Very extended, but it is the teaser before the credits. It sets up the whole situation, which then plays out through the rest of the episode. Saying the previous characters, their wigs are very good, or their hair.
Yeah. It seems though, unfortunately, they spent all their money on those wigs. And then these guys, they were just like, you know, we're just going to raise your eyebrows up a little bit. Which is a bit of a weird thing to me.
It does sort of work in a weird way, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you got to make, well, you don't have to, but I mean, any attempt that they did to make people look like alien or different from what we know, I always do appreciate that. Although this is back in an era when everybody also dressed alike as aliens.
But I think it works well in the sense that, oh, well, maybe not when you get close. But I was going to say, you know, the little ridges in Star Trek, which became the staple alien iconography through the 90s. But actual higher eyebrows is very effective because it sort of changes the proportions to a face. You know, where your eyes are suddenly sort of grows, makes faces look longer.
Yeah. Except are they making an attempt to make it look just like higher eyebrows or secondary eyebrows?
I think they're meant to be higher, and then they're hoping that the light won't catch.
That's makeup there.
Yeah, because it's only on those close shots you can tell. They'll find them first. No, I don't think they want to be discovered when they find out about this place. If they hide, they'll hide from us. Yeah, it's a shame as well, as you say, that, again, in that simplistic afterlife effect, that characters are iconed by their clothes, you know.
Wait a minute, did I just read that one of these guys was Jeremy Bullock, Boba Fett from Star Wars?
Yeah, probably. One of them looked like Jeremy Bullock.
Wow, I don't think I've ever known that little fact.
No, nor have I. And I've not actually got the subtitles on for this, so you're going to be the...
Oh, no? Ha-ha, I've got the cheating method now.
Yeah, you have the power.
I love this.
That would have been hilarious if you'd actually killed them all.
It's so great, though, but I like it. Like, they're in this, like, mortal danger, and Ian's just, like, playing like a kid with a he's playing toy soldier there, you know?
But even there, he's
so terrible, though.
But yeah, I love his acting there. I mean, even here, he's still got that sort of slightly jovial.
Yeah.
While he's doing that dialogue, constantly reminding everyone that he's got this gun, and it is all a bit of a... I'm surprised no one's gifted that with him killing them all.
Too close to home these days, I guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He also looks a little, look at him right there, standing there with that serious look. It looks a little badass. Like, yeah, that's right. I got the gun, everybody. Like, you want to call the shots, Doctor? No, it's me today.
I still think it was always a shame, even though it was an inevitability for the show's longevity, that his part becomes not necessarily downscaled, but it loses his authority. Certainly his moral authority in the show.
Yeah. Well, once they made the shift to the Doctor not being more of the foil,
yeah,
you know, it was kind of like, it's a shame because it made sense for Ian to go, because once you had two people fulfilling the same role, it was a little redundant. And it's a shame because, as I always say to people, the first Doctor is the Doctor that I always thought, man, it would be fun to travel with this guy. Whereas all the other Doctors are the ones that I usually thought, man, it would be great to be that guy.
Right.
You know, because in this series, like I always wanted to be Ian. You know, he was the heroic one. He was the brave one and the moral center, as you said, you know. And then the first Doctor was just either that foil, that crotchety old man. Or then he made that switch to being that nicer guy a little bit later on. But I still don't picture myself wanting to be him as much as I did Ian.
But I've always found William Russell, not William Russell, Ian. I've never met William Russell, but I found Ian as a character to be the sort of very quintessential, in my eyes, I'm not saying in everyone else, quintessential male, almost perfection, I'd say. This is what I would say a man should be, in the sense that he's not... I wouldn't say he's sexist, or there's no real prejudice in the guy. There's a lot of compassion in him, yet there's a lot of strength there as well. And so when I see characters in shows like Bill Bixby's David Banner in Incredible Hulk, who's got a sort of feel to him as well. I suppose you could argue almost Sheridan in Babylon 5 is a little more right wing than I like, but that sort of mixture of gentle sensitivity, but yet there's a strength there, I think is a very compelling male character. There's no sort of stupid, sort of quirky, cold sense of humour, you know, the ad-libby fun lines that you get in Heroes these days.
Sure.
He's a very straight character. His weakness is obviously when he is trying to be funny, and he never really quite manages it.
What people would call dad humour.
Yeah,
today,
dad humour.
Yeah.
There is a dad humour to a character who is not actually meant to be a father. But I suppose he is to some degree playing a paternal role within this group, though.
Yeah.
But I think
you could argue that about a lot of teachers in that era, you know, like teachers, you know, they weren't like what we had when we went to school, which were people who are, at least here in America, people who are a little bit terrified to even talk to the students. It's a terrible thing to say, but many of them didn't relate in any kind of way aside from, hey, I'm the teacher, you're the student kind of thing. I tell you to do things, you do it kind of stuff. And these guys, they seem like they're really invested in their students. I mean, like following her home to make sure she's okay. A little creepy, but they're just making sure of her safety, you know?
But this is what I thought was so brilliant about the show. I mean, on two levels. First level, you go back to An Earthly Child. What's really nice there is that there is even that honesty in their dialogue where they sort of say, yes, it's not just because we care. It's also because we're curious, which I thought was a lovely lovely admission of character, which, you know, shows wouldn't have done. But they do continue to feel like teachers. And then you've got this beautiful inversion where the teachers become the pupils to this concept which is far beyond their understandings. But again, and I know we're sort of negging a bit on the more recent ones, but you never got that with Clara, and that was possibly because she was never initially a teacher. You know, they sort of almost arbitrarily gave her that so they could put Coal Hill School in there. And I suspect at that point that was one of the shows that Moffat was trying to pitch out and wasn't getting much luck with at the time, was the class idea.
But, yeah, I mean, well, that always just seemed shoehorned into that story. I thought more so, I mean, you're probably right about class, but I thought more so it was just, hey, I want to have Coal Hill School on the 50th anniversary. How can I do that? Oh, right, Clara's a teacher now. You know, it just didn't work. It
but
didn't
she,
sell.
She didn't feel like a teacher, and she did work as a teacher, and being a teacher didn't have any influence in the dynamic of what she was doing. But here you have it in the way, nothing else, in the way that the actors have carried on and not lost that original core characters from the first episode.
Yeah, and I know that a lot of people say that, like, you know, when we talk about that the original concept for Doctor Who was that it was supposed to teach children something about science and history, and people are like, oh, that's bullshit. And it's like, well, no, you know what? It's actually not. When you watch it, they are actually teaching you scientific and history things in those historical shows, and even in, like, the Daleks, when they have that scene with the magnet, how to escape.
Yeah.
Not the Daleks, but the Dalek invasion of Earth.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're still trying to show you some things, even if that's not the main focus. They're doing that kind of stuff, and I like that kind of fact that, you know, like Susan is there, and now Vicky, and not only is the Doctor able to teach them these things, but so are the two companions. You really don't get that, especially. And this isn't a down on Rose, but, you know, you're never going to see Rose teaching somebody something like that. You know, she could teach them more streetwise kind of stuff or compassion. You know, but I liked this aspect that everybody was just kind of like, okay, we're stuck in this situation. We're teachers. Let's continue this kid's education.
Well, someone was saying recently, and I'm trying to think where it was or where I was reading, and it's very, very true that it's obviously something that most people will consider. It's not a brand new idea, but heroes on film, especially through America, have worked on a sort of very, again, a very sort of libertarian sort of approach that those who are not governed and not educated are often the ones who are considered to be the righteous. So teachers sort of lose out on that, you know, to succeed, it's about being streetwise. It's about having instinct and gut feelings. You know, the most obvious example of this is Star Wars, where all the lead characters, all the heroes, are not educated characters. They're workers. You know, they're farmers, they're, you know, smugglers, stroke lorry drivers, essentially.
Yeah.
And all the people who are intelligent, you know, they've built these large weapons of mass destruction, which have to be stopped. And
I suppose Leia would be the only difference for that, because, I mean, obviously she was a princess and an educated character within the story.
To a degree, yes, but she never uses her education, does she? I mean,
well,
she's not particularly
educated.
It's
in her leadership skills, I guess. I mean, she's not. They're not showing her like as a scientist.
And also,
like that.
She in the end becomes enamored with the, in their relationship. The initially, the strong character is more Solo than her. It's in Empire, it's him dominating her. In scenes which are quite, you know, quite pushy, and she supplicates to it. I'm not saying it's a perfect example, but I'm just saying
generally speaking,
that is where it goes. And so when you get to Rose, I would almost argue that sort of ideology of that sort of I would probably call Americanism. It probably isn't just America, to be fair, sort of starts to filter through. And so by Rose, you've still got this thing now that, it's, you know, the heroes, bar the Doctor, who is a sort of oddity, aren't particularly educated. They sort of survive through their sort of gut instincts, their wit, but not their intelligence. And to be fair to Doctor Who, that's not necessarily to be about that American template. It could simply by separating out intelligence in the Doctor with smarts and savvy in the companion to create strength and dynamic. But anyway, it gets back to the point. Is I can't imagine having, you know, teachers like this in, you know, people of education really leading stories.
No.
I think that is simply, and I'm always a bit cautious about just sort of making it sound like I'm blaming America. I think it's simply more television realizing that the vast amount of people watching are not going to be teachers and scientists and educators. They're going to be people who work, and they work hard, and they could be smart people, but they're not scientists. Okay, thank you, Ian, for just pulling that face while trying to attack that cloth and sort of reducing my point. But the point being is that the majority of mass audiences are reflected in instincts and smarts. That's how they would see themselves. So maybe that is why television sort of goes down that route, where you just don't have.
You know what, though? I'm with you here, but talking about all that education and being smart people, they were not very wise with Barbara using that knife to pull apart her cardigan with all their faces right in the knife's path as she popped the threads. That was not very smart. We're gonna have a pretty cool moment coming up here for the Doctor, though, and I know I'm jumping ahead, even though we're kind of here, but I love this kind of interrogation scene that he gets put into.
Yes.
So right now we're in the chamber. The Doctor is, for those of you not watching at home, the Doctor is in the chamber right now, just woken up after being kidnapped. And he's, you know, he's searching around, but he's going to sit in this cool chair, another little neat device. That's pretty cool. I mean, it's really just like a clear, like, plexiglass box with lights in it kind of thing. Well, plexiglass chair-shaped box, but it's neat.
Yes, again, not very smart. Now, if he had a bit of gut instinct about him, a bit of savvy, a bit of Han Solo, a bit of Indiana Jones. Well, actually, Indiana Jones is totally against that, isn't he? He is a smart man, but he's a smart man.
He's also a teacher.
And he's a teacher, but he leaves that behind, by and large, to become the action hero template.
Right.
With occasional moments of...
He does have it. He does teach people things, you know.
Well, I think in the end, society, we tend to celebrate instinct and intuition over knowledge. I think that's the bottom line. And
no,
knowledge becomes like a icing on the cake.
I think it's more so that people have a short attention span anymore. So when you have a scene that's dialogue heavy with information, they get lost. Whereas if you have a scene of somebody just pulling out a gun and shooting someone on instinct, you know, they cheer and they hoot and they holler and it sells more films. And it's kind of sad, you know. Taking the X-Files, when that came back, one of the big complaints that everybody had about the first episode was that Mulder and then Tad O'Malley both had like really long expositional scenes about what they thought the government conspiracy was. I lap that stuff up. I think it's fantastic, you know, but a lot of people were just like, oh, it went on too long. I didn't understand it. It was just like, well, okay, just listen to the words. Maybe you'll understand it, you know, and we can't have that stuff now. Like a conversation like this, you can have because it's almost like the main villain meets the hero. So this scene here where the Doctor's being interrogated is great, but having someone explain information anymore is generally done in a variety of different ways in a story to make scenes not be so quote long and boring.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in the end you get characters which are not really built around anything but archetypes which suit that sort of story. Clara, it's more important that Clara has those attributes which suit that sort of story type, the sass, the instinct, the guts, and education, knowledge, and as you say, articulation, because those things are just not useful in the sort of stories that are to be told.
Yep. A simple matter of thought
selection. I mean, even the Doctor, to some degree, you know, his science is very much... It's very rarely to do with, I know a lot of people complained about this in New Who, haven't they, that he very rarely saved the day through science. It would be saved the day through what they would consider to be magic, be it a sonic screwdriver or something done through emotions and
Here's something in this particular scene, and I'm sorry not to interrupt that, but in that interrogation scene there, it's brilliant because this, you know, the Inquisitor tells the doctor, hey, just by planting this seed, I can on this computer screen see what comes to mind. So when he talks about, you know, his friends, the doctor thinks of his friends and it's on that computer screen. And it's great because once the doctor knows that, being I'm going to say a superior alien race here just because the Time Lords have that intellect, so I'm just going to throw it out there just because it works for this conversation. He can go ahead and manipulate what's on screen for those questions. He knows what's happening, so he can manipulate what they're seeing. And I think that's great. But at the same time, that Inquisitor probably really shouldn't tell people that he is questioning that's how his device works, because you're probably going to get a heck of a lot more useful information if they have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah, very true. I suppose in the end, intelligence, what I think is funny is intelligence becomes a superpower, doesn't it, in these sort of shows. When they show intelligence or they use intellect, it's like a superpower rather than an expectant.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is one of the ways that they do, even in the new series, or for sure in the new series, rather, they treat the Doctor as like his smarts are that. And it comes down to that hero worship thing that I can't stand in the new series, that, you know, he's... Everybody knows of him and everybody's dying to meet him, and it's just like, you know what, like I miss these days. This guy has no idea who the Doctor is.
But this is, I think what's nice about these days is, I mean, here he has a one-upmanship here, but he is still very vulnerable.
Yes.
And his intellect does not necessarily win over brute force. Or,
and there's also a time when, like, you know, he understands now what happened because this guy explained to him the technology, but maybe he's not used to the technology, you know, of somebody asking him questions and his thoughts appearing on the screen. He probably is aware of it. He probably gets it, especially since we know of telepathy and their Time Lord's abilities later on. But I like the fact that, you know, this guy's asking him questions and the Doctor just doesn't assume that, oh, that TV scene set over there, I know exactly what that is. You know, like in the new series, it's very difficult for the Doctor not to know what something is. We get a little bit of it. And it's so hard to double back on that. You can't. You've done the lonely God thing. You've done that he's so smart, he understands every bit of technology thing. And there's very few things until you introduce an alien race that he's never met before or heard of before, which is difficult in itself. With the way the show is to do that, especially since he's been around so long now.
But I mean, it adds to the tension, doesn't it? I mean, like there, he has his one-upmanship, as you say, over the machine.
Yeah.
But ultimately, there's Jeremy Bullock as Tor.
Yeah, there is.
Ultimately, he ends up in no better situation than he was. So, yes. You know, I think that's kind of...
That all comes down to time, though. Like, back then, we had time to play with. And you know... Some will argue, and in some cases it's true, that this stuff is padding. You know, to pad out a 4-episode story, you have to keep having the characters be foiled more often than not. Whereas in a 1-hour episode, you can't do that thing, or even a 2-parter, you can't do that sort of stuff. But it's a shame. I like that. That was, you know, a lot of people, that movie, The Tourist, did you see that movie?
No.
Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie?
No, I didn't.
A lot of people really poo-pooed that movie, and I found that out after I had seen it, and I really enjoyed the heck out of it. I thought it was a great movie. It really, like, harkened back to, like, a 60s kind of caper movie for me. and it was because they took the time to let scenes unfold. A lot of people talked about how it was slow or this, that, and the other. And I don't know, maybe it's not the best movie ever written, you know, but I enjoyed it for those 2 hours I was in there because they took a different approach to telling a story. And I was glad to see that happening. And now I'm noticing if you watch a lot of films since that one came out, especially the James Bond films, they're allowing scenes to unfold. Like, certainly the newest one, Spectre, the newest one really took time to let scenes unfold and drag is what most people would say. But that seems like a derogatory way to say it. But it was great because when the action needed to be action, it was still great action. But when they needed to have a scene, which was exposition, happen, they really just allowed it to breathe is probably the best way to put it. And that's what's happening here. That's what I like about these old stories. That's why I like TV shows and films from this era. You get time to breathe. You get time to know the people, the surroundings, and the situation.
Yes, very much so. And I think it's even in the last 25, 30 years, you still see that with, you know, say take Wrath of Khan to Into Darkness. There's a difference in, and I know Fair Wrath of Khan was a very unusually good franchise film, but the difference is in style techniques for both were aiming at mass media audiences, and one was very character-based and the other was just, you know, trying to, you know, I don't know really how to explain it, but I'm sure a Star Trek podcast would do better.
Yeah, right.
So, no, well, yes, we're on to episode 3. I'm enjoying it. I must admit, I'm hoping that our conversation is broad enough for those who are not actually watching with us can get something out of it. I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I know this has been talked about a lot, but it's always interesting when you've got the lead character of this show who is about intellect, and yet so much of Doctor Who is about either the abuse or the waste or the domination of intellect. If it's down to people using machines like that thought machine, which had to be subverted,
right?
Or governments bringing in certain machines, or people being bureaucratic, being overly logical, or, you know, like, you know, machines, war machines, or even Daleks to a degree, and that the Cybermen certainly. There's always that sort of odd tension between the fact that intellect is good, like the Doctor, but virtually in every other case it's bad. So there's almost like there's a sort of authoritarian agenda of the Doctor to make sure that everyone else in the world is stupid, and only he is accepted as the quirky genius.
I hadn't really thought about it like that before. That's kind of funny.
But it always does seem that way, that there is a sort of Doctor has always had this sort of very anti-government, anti-control, where, you know, freedom is important, that hierarchies are often a trouble and officious and bureaucratic, and machines are always controlling, careless, inaccurate, or again dominating.
You know, I'm surprised that you and I as prop people aren't like mentioning a lot of these other
absolutely,
things in the cases.
Absolutely. Maybe we should sort of step back and be boring for a bit.
Yeah, right. No, seriously. Well, I mean, it's a space museum, so these things are all supposed to be like space related, like ship related or things from space and so on. And I find that kind of fascinating. Like, there aren't paintings in this museum, you know.
Are you surprised that there wasn't more use of back props? I mean, because I'm sure a lot of them must have still existed.
Well, you know, reading some of the notes, I was interested to find that, like, there was a hallway scene with a couple of tables, and apparently they were from the Sensorites. You know, and of course, you know, the Dalek is an obvious one, but it did make me wonder, like, how many of these other things had we seen, or how many of them were parts of something that we've seen, you know? So I'm trying to look at them and even, like, figure that out, because some of the stuff just has to be junk they had lying around, and some of it had to have been used before. There's no way that, like, all of this stuff is just new to this episode, you know. But I also wonder what shows they're from.
But I sort of like the fact that there is no massive intercontinuity in this, which I'm sure there will be in new show. There'd been a lot more suggestion of nods to past events. Even what's the name of that Big Finish story, that's another Ian Chesterton one, William Russell. Is it Time Museum or something, where he's have you heard that one?
I don't know the companion ones very well.
No, it's one which is, but it is kind of great in the sense that it explores all his past adventures, because it's such a massive time museum, and it's old Ian Chesterton stuck in it. But at the same time, it sort of almost constricts it, because it is so intercontinuity.
Yeah.
And I kind of like the fact that, because there is actually nothing much really that we recognize, it sort of suggests again that there's something which is not just universe big, but time big.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and if they had just filled it with like a Cyberman head or something like that,
yeah, exactly.
Which obviously didn't come around at this point, but, you know, other familiar things from other stories, it would have been a walk down memory lane. It kind of would have been like forgotten for me, that comic book series with the Doctor and Martha stuck in that, you know. Where in one hand, that was kind of cool because it was kind of like, wow, all of these things are so connected to the Doctor. But I wouldn't want to see every story like that. And I think that is part of my issue with like the new series, with not only does the Doctor know everything, but everybody seems to know the Doctor. So there's no world that you get to go to that isn't somehow new. And that's what's so beautiful about this one right here, even though it's like a world with a space museum and they have a Dalek in there. So clearly not everything on this planet is space to their own selves. It's interesting in the respect that like we could go there. As a matter of fact, there's another museum that they go to in the second Doctor's era. The Seeds of Death.
Seeds of Death. Museum.
And that's great. It's just a space museum, you know, it's neat to think that us as time travelers could go to these things and still find things of interest in them, you know, I guess maybe like if you look at something like Dalek from 2005, the series one, you know, it makes sense that stuff in there would be familiar to us. But I liked also how it was a mix. They had the Roswell Milometer in there and they had other like a meteorite of some sort, you know, and I like that it was a little bit of a mix because I guess you're taking the fan into the Doctor Who world since that's series one, you know, but series two, series three wouldn't need that.
It always looked to me they had a Xenomorph egg in there as well, which I always thought was, if you look in the background in one of the shots, if you go back and look, there's one very oval, oddly textured egg to have a look at that. I mean, I always found that really weird because I thought, oh my God, is that actually a prop, is that a real joke or is it just, you know, the trick of the light? But anyway, I know, I agree, and I think one of the ones I think we're gonna have to do in the future, even though it is very long, would be Seeds of Death, because it's one of my favorite all-time Doctor Who's. That it just has everything that makes Doctor Who great to me in that story.
We could do that one. Hell, I mean, we can certainly split it up into two easily.
It's a great story that's very underrated,
or possibly three, as we had learned with Delta and the Bannermen.
Ah, oh, that's such a good story, Delta and the Bannermen. This is so we started to tread into what would. I'm trying to think now. Had it really sort of headed in this direction before this, or was this sort of a direction the Doctor Who would often move into after it? This sort of split into obviously the oppressed and the oppressors, split the companions in between the two. I mean, this sort of thing was going on all the way to Paradise Towers.
Yeah, we did have that in the Sensorites, I would say. Because there was sort of like, well, I mean, the humans that were stuck there were, I guess, the oppressed.
Not massively. It wasn't really structured as part of, a societal thing.
The Daleks.
Daleks to a degree, but then you didn't have them split between them and the Daleks because they would be exterminated. I suppose the last couple of episodes you did start to have that, where Susan and Doctor are captured. But by and large, this sort of thing sort of became a very strong part of the Doctor Who framework, where you'd have your two groups, your oppressed and your oppressives, or just two very different types, and they would swap between the two. You know, companion would get caught.
Yeah.
One that springs to mind straight away is the Time Warrior, where you have Sarah ending up with one castle, Dr. Stock with Iron Gron.
That's actually what I was just going to say, too, is more so like in this era, it would have just been more so the historicals where that sort of thing actually happened in history.
Yes. Love his accent. Bless his northern socks. It's just very interesting because, I mean, obviously, something that's always been said that I think is very true is, you know, go back to this era, you didn't get many different regional voices in, you know, people didn't really experience them because British television was always done by a sort of very upper middle class culture. And then slowly through television and radio, you'd start getting these mixes of accents coming out in these sort of broad regions, which would never have got. I mean, was American television sort of ever like that in the 50s? Was there certain regions? Was there sort of like that? Obviously, to the British, was that sort of southern twang or that sort of deep Bronx, New York? Were those sort of things which were there? Or was it, again, very sterile?
You could, I mean, if you take it back further to something like I Love Lucy or The Honeymooners, you got regional voices, certainly, you know. But a lot of, more so it was in our films, like the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, there was, and I've learned this recently, actually, is that, you know, you hear actors like Cary Grant, I'm trying to think now, like Audrey Hepburn and even Katharine Hepburn and a few others of the era, like all Gregory Peck, people just like of that time, they all kind of had this way of speaking about them that was very much taught to them or something they had to pick up to be a particular upper class because they were these actors. You know, it wasn't how they spoke. You know, it was just how they had to be, like the inflection that they would put on words or the accent that they would have. So I don't know if it was anything like we have to do this, but it was a lot of time. I noticed that there were a lot of actors at the time in our films in that era who were not British that I used to question, like, are they British? You know, and I know some of them were, a couple of them, but I used to question that just because the way that they did say things, they had this slight Britishness to them. And apparently it was a class kind of thing to do here. And then that went away pretty quickly. Certainly, I don't remember too much 60s TV being that way. The main thing is like I always talk about here, like my own accent, for example, like, you know, it's very similar to what is seen in a lot of our films and TV shows. And I usually call it the base accent, you know, the blank. You don't usually get TV shows where someone has a Southern accent as a main character unless they're playing a Southerner, right? You know, deliberately, you know, it's just not something that is usually on TV. You would get it in certain TV shows, like Dukes of Hazzard might have had it, you know, but consider what the Dukes of Hazzard was, you know. So yeah, we did, but I don't think we had it to the degree you guys had it, and it certainly stayed with your television for quite a long time with the received pronunciation. I do want to point out one thing here. We're in a different scene now, but that one fight scene we were talking about where you brought up the accent.
Yeah,
there was a show note that had said that a man of Ian's age at this time that he is from, a guy of his age would have served 2 years in the British military already. And I found that interesting, you know, like just to know that someone like that apparently, as they're making it sound in the show notes, was just the norm. So when you're seeing Ian use weapons or fight, you know, like I always picture things like Clara as a school teacher. Where we'll just bring her out as she's the school teacher example we have of the new series, getting in fight scenes and so on. Like you would have to think that she would have taken some kind of like kickboxing class or something like that. But whereas here, Ian would have had military training already, you know, like otherwise I would sit there and I would think of me traveling with the doctor and getting put in situations. My fight skills would be very much throw punches, hope you hit something. You know what I mean? Because I'm not a trained fighter. But here he would have had those military skills already, and it lends a lot of weight to him being the action character of this era. But it's just interesting to know that little fact, and I guess like a lot of people wouldn't know that. I certainly wouldn't have known that. You know, so otherwise he would just seem, again, kind of people like, this guy's a school teacher? Like, where'd he learn to fight like that? You know what I mean?
Do you think there would be any interest in, I mean, people have always sort of feared the idea of a Doctor Who reboot, but if they did do like they did with, as they do in comics, where they don't reboot it in a sense where they just start totally blank, but they almost redo from the origins. So you, and it doesn't mean that you'd stop doing Doctor Who, but I just kind of wondering what it'd be like if they actually tried to redo the story of, and perhaps even stick with it for a long time, of Ian, Barbara, Susan and the Doctor, and do it as it would be now, but try and sort of stay close to the authenticity of the characters of then. So, you know,
yeah.
Barbara doesn't just turn into another Rose or a Donna, but is written like Barbara, and Ian is written like Ian, but you get to sort of see them fleshed into in production where it's not truncated by, you know, the issues of time, money, the fact that no one really believed in it, particularly bar the sort of people producing it and the writers, hopefully, and the actors, obviously.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to see how it'd go, even if they did it in book form, I guess. I mean, I suppose they have to a degree, with some of the books were done in a sort of very, Byzantium is an obvious example. Where there's a lot of background to Ian Chesterton's in that, but sorry, yeah.
Oh, here you go. There's a show note here that just said the Space Museum was the first Doctor Who story to do a revolution.
There we go.
So there you are.
Yeah.
Well, real quick, to your thought there, there's a couple of things that I always wanted to see. Like, I wanted to see in the new series that they would get a companion. And I've said for a while, from the 60s, because back in the 60s, getting a companion like Jamie or Victoria was great, because they were past companions, you know, and that, and, you know, because clearly your modern world for the viewer was the 60s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here we are in 2016, and I think it would be great to get a companion from the 60s. But at the same time, I don't want to see them say this person's from the 60s and have them act very much as if they're from today.
Yeah.
You know, I want them to write this person as if they actually are from the 60s. They have ideals from the 60s. They have mentalities from the 60s and things that, you know, can get expanded on for them as they see the outside world, outside their own timeline, see their future or alien worlds grow from that, you know. And I don't mean I want to see them be prejudiced or jerks or something like that, but I do want to see them be, you know, have ideals of their era that match their era, rather than be somebody
yes,
who just doesn't belong there in the first place.
Definitely, yes. That would be the idea, would be not to sort of, as you say, do an updated version, but to do a version, I suppose, better, with the hindsight of the skills of writing and television. So you'd have a 60s character like Ian would be written like Ian would be in the 60s, not as, you know, as you say, the quick talking smart ass of today. And that to me would be, I mean, like Sam Tyler going back to Life on Mars is a sort of a very similar Ian Chesterton character in a lot of ways. He's quite a soft, very liberal, friendly, but sort of slightly authoritative when he needs to be, yet gentle. So you could imagine sort of doing an Ian Chesterton from the 60s in a today's reboot. And you, I just think you know, because I mean, obviously this is great Doctor Who, but there are times where you feel, I wish it could have just got a little more under the surface of who Ian is and what he's feeling and those sort of things, which you'd be able, you can do in sort of modern day television occasionally.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would be great. And I'll tell you what, like back in 2003, I believe that was the original announcement for the new series. I remembered being one of those people that was like, a reboot, how could you? Like, because I still don't really like the ideas of,
no,
of
yeah,
many
absolutely.
Reboots. You know what I mean? Like if especially a TV show like Doctor Who, which is built in to continue, I just didn't want to see a reboot. Now that we've had a continuation and I see what it has evolved into, I kind of, in many ways, wish they did do a reboot now, because they would have had so much more freedom had they done a reboot. You know, instead, what they tried to do was invent freedom for themselves by writing around things that were already established or rewriting things that were already established. Whereas I think it would have been so much better if the world was introduced to the Doctor in the same way that Rose was introduced to the Doctor. He was brand new and there was no history behind him because they were starting from scratch with him. Nobody in the universe knew who the Doctor was. I think it would have been so much better 10 years on now. Well, obviously 11 now, I guess. To see where the world of Doctor Who, New Who, would have been with this character having only really kind of been around for that short time.
I know it's terrible to say, but I absolutely agree with you. I at the time, the thought of a reboot was absolutely no. And, you know, the thought that you had to pick up, like in End of the World, where they do the scan of the Doctor and there's a suggestion that there's sort of like 9 different DNA traces on the scanner. That was the only suggestion really of proper continuity. But now looking back, I would love to do a decent smart reboot where you'd get to explore the world of the Doctor from the beginning and see, and we're so used to it in comics, we're so used to seeing it with things like Batman or Spider-Man where they you know restart or even do one-offs and so you get to really sort of explore these characters from different angles. But it would just be great to see a new Doctor, totally clean, first encounter Daleks, to have someone like Ian and Barbara, and hopefully sort of sign them on so they stay on for a damn sight longer, because it's just such a good, it's, you know, it's the Ian, it's the Spock, McCoy, Kirk strength that, you know, why get rid of it if it works? And let them explore, and that would be, and also, as you say, because you've got that foreknowledge of the universe, you'd be exploring it with old and new eyes, and that's exciting too.
And you know, honestly, I mean, technically the TV show could do that, because as you pointed out, Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, all those comic books have done it. They've either done it within their own book respectively, where they change the characters' lives so drastically due to some kind of event in their lives, or they do it with the entire universe, like DC's 52.
Yeah.
Or even the one that just happened with Marvel lately after Secret Wars 2. You could do it within the universe where, and I'll tell you what, man, when they rebooted the universe with Big Bang 2, that probably would have been a great point for them to go, okay, we're just going to do a clean slate now. Boom, everything's
done.
Well,
he kept doing that, didn't he? Because then he does the whole thing at the end of the death of the Doctor with Matt Smith, where he wipes the universe of his knowledge of his existence.
Yeah.
And you get again this suggestion of, we want to just go back to being a wanderer who no one knows, but within an episode or two again, back to normal.
Yeah, everybody knows him again. It was a waste. There were so many, and you know, we rag on Moff, as people tell us, but you know what? I mean, look at it. Just literally look at that one situation. You just wiped the universe of memory of the Doctor. You wiped the Daleks of memory of the Doctor, and within like a couple episodes later, everybody knew the Doctor. So like, what was the point of doing it? Like, why do that if you're not going to stick to your guns on it, you know? Or have a reason for why the wipe didn't take. You know, that would have at least been acceptable too. I don't know. I think certainly after the last couple of years of the show just kind of staggering for me and not really being as magical as it once was, it would be interesting to see them just be completely free of the constraints that they have had themselves locked into.
Yeah.
And I know we're straying so far from this episode, which episode 3 has actually just ended now, attention. But
this leads a question. I mean, this is where I think sometimes the reboot does become an exciting idea, is if you get away from the fact that if you did a reboot and you can I'm looking at, say, Battlestar Galactica, and I know a lot of Battlestar Galactica fans hated the reboot. Or the revision, and there was a lot of them who didn't even like the revision after it ended. But the idea where you can sort of take new takes on old stories, so you could do the Space Museum again, take that very basic premise, perhaps remove, as you say, the revolution from it, and you'd have a different story where you'd sort of slightly know where it could go or where it should go or where it might go, making it a little more interactive.
Well, and think about what we said earlier in the beginning of this podcast, or the beginning of this, the commentary for this story, which was, you know, we would like to see them deal a bit more with the aspect that got them there, or the main threat to them, their actual trying to escape this reality of theirs. And this story is dealing with that, obviously. But,
yeah.
You know, take a reboot. And maybe even if you don't want to use Ian, Barbara, and Susan, which would be a shame if you were in a reboot to not, but hey, reboot's supposed to be total freedom. But take the reboot and go back to season one of this particular first story, or season one and two. You could probably make a very strong season one if you just combine the best episodes of season one and two and do rewrites of them where you go into more depth. Like you said, like with Ian and Barbara get thrust into the TARDIS in the very first episode, and, you know, they get kidnapped. You know, and then within like the next story, you know, they're not cool with the idea, but they're like, well, we got to work with this guy, you know, to survive. We really should have seen more turmoil there, more character conflictions between the two, you know, and just think what new writers could do with that. You know, that would be such an interesting thing, especially if you, I mean, it would probably take them a full series before you have Ian and Barbara start to really trust the Doctor, rather than like just a couple episodes where you got to go, well, we're building to our format. We need them to be okay now, you know?
That's exactly. And
that would be a story arc that is much better than the story arcs that they've been attempting to do for the past few years.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, I totally agree. And I kind of just, there's other reboots in my mind that just, I can't quite think which ones I'm thinking of. But you also get that excitement that you would, if they carried it to a certain amount of a linear relationship to the original, you would know in the future, in a few years' time, you would get a version of Jamie.
Yeah.
And that would be interesting. Or even a version of Stephen. And Stephen might be redone a little to make him a little more his own personality than this just slightly more angry version of Ian.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's very honest, and it's funny, isn't it? It takes a simple little story like the Space Museum to bring you to this conclusion. But a reboot could be really, really interesting. And I think you're right. I think part of it is that there is a certain magic which has been lost from the continuation. It's become a bit of a frustrating show. And something new would be exciting. I think we've had a lot of Doctor Who, that old Doctor Who, and seeing how it could explore all these ideas from the start without, as you say, without conflicting or having tension with old thoughts. I mean, as long as in the first episode they didn't hire Jenna Coleman to appear to wave at the camera at one point as the Doctor steals a TARDIS. But I think it could be quite, I think it could be a really fascinating project.
Yeah, no, I think it would actually breathe new life into the series. Now, granted, a lot of people would be upset because, you know, they, like, we'll just look at it this way. Like, a lot of fans came on with the new series. They already know that that continuity is there, and they have continuity of their own. Even if they don't watch the classic series, they know that that existed, but they have continuity of their own within the new series now. So they would be just as upset as we originally were at the thought of a reboot in 2003.
Yeah.
But I think if it's done well, I think if people start to watch and see what you can do, you know, you'd get some naysayers where, like, the Doctor would come out and meet the Daleks and they were like, well, he already knew them and defeated them before. It's like, yeah, great. So he did. This one doesn't know them. And think what you can do there, especially knowing what the Daleks have become throughout the whole, like, 50 some odd years the show has been on. That you can start there with that. There's no getting to know them. There's no awkwardness of what these characters' purposes are, or even the Cybermen. You know what works and doesn't work with them. So you can just start from day one telling what works with them as an origin story. You know, there's so many great things that you can do. And even taking characters like Dodo, Mel, or Adric, you don't have to write them off or not use them, but you can figure out, like, okay, these characters should have worked. Why didn't they work?
Yeah.
And let's make them work. Let's make people like our version of them. And there's so much that you could do. And even like, you know, and to say a reboot, this doesn't mean that they have to have somebody dressed like William Hartnell playing the first Doctor. You know, they can do their version of what they feel their first Doctor is that is stuck with these two teachers and the Doctor's granddaughter. I don't think a reboot needs to be... like the way a movie version essentially would be of this, where you dress everybody the same, but you either do caricatures of them if you're going to do a parody, which I hate when people revive old TV shows just to do a parody. But more so, like, you're doing an expansion on what this life was like, a more real, almost like you're doing what they would do with actors today, where they tell biopics of what their life was like during the time they worked on the show. The hell, they did it with Doctor Who.
Yeah, The Adventures in Time and Space. I mean, this is... But this is what I think is interesting, is that there's no doubt that Doctor Who was flawed and is still flawed and will always be flawed. So in a way, it's sort of a chance to go back and attack and try and address those things, do something different that doesn't say that it's better. It's just trying again, knowing where things didn't quite work and seeing if you can make them work and or make them work differently. And I think that would be... Because, I mean, there's no way that, you know, we know that if they did a series of this now, that we would get, like, as you know, 90-minute episodes of each of these stories, add more. So, you know, William Hartnell's era could last for 5-6 years, and it wouldn't happen like that. But
no.
It wouldn't be the perfect thing, but it'd just be interesting to see them try and... I don't know, attack the original material again from a different angle, but an authentic angle. And not everyone would like it, but then hell, no one likes anything. Everyone doesn't like anything.
No.
It doesn't happen. And I just think it would be interesting. It'd be interesting for a new era of fans. But I think you're right. I think it is fascinating that as classic fans balked at the new series is the original classic series for a lot of new fans. And
yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
But yeah, I'd be tempted to do would be to give an ending to Doctor Who. Not something that's absolutely definitive. You could always go back to it. But, you know, whether he ended up in a nice cottage on Allen's Road, you know, content with himself, and, you know, he had some sort of closure of some sort, and then you did a reboot, it'd be very interesting. You could always go back to that original continuity if it didn't work, but I don't know. I just see so much potential in these shows. I think that's it. It is.
Sure. You know, that would even be interesting too, if the new series decided to end the show, and let's just say with Capaldi, just since he's here, but he gets that home, like you said. He sits down, he's content. He finally is like, you know what, like, the universe is a good place. This is great. I'm going to sit here in my cottage and enjoy life. And then all of a sudden there's a device sitting next to him. And he just sees that device. Like, he gets this happy ending, but once that device goes off, boom, we get to see the first Doctor on Gallifrey stealing the TARDIS and leaving again. Like, time has just been reset, rebooted. Like, whatever the Doctor thought he did to save the universe and everything, somebody got him, and now he's getting to start his life over again, and he's got to try and do all that stuff the same way, but he's not aware of it. I don't want the new guy, that reboot, to be aware of it, but it would just be for the audience. Like, hey, things ended well, but darn. Well, guess what? He's doing it again.
Well, I still always like the old Battlestar Galactica idea of, you know, it's happened before, it's happened again, which is not a new idea.
Yeah.
But this idea that everything is circular, that you could have eventually the same things happening again. Universe ends, universe starts again. You have a new legacy for everyone. It's just slightly different. And it doesn't mean the last legacy didn't happen. It doesn't mean the last legacy was subverted or... It did happen. It's still, in its sense, continuity, but, you know, universes go round.
You know, it's strange, too, because I'm trying to think of good examples of TV shows or movies that I look at as I enjoy them both. But to me, it's just kind of like, you know, here's kind of the way DC and Marvel do it. Like, here's Earth 1, here's Earth 2 kind of thing, or it's 616, et cetera, however they do it. And sadly, the only one I can really come up with right now is the A-Team. I've been watching the A-Team lately, and I went to watch the film last night, and it was like, you know, the film's nice. It's not the same, but it's nice. But it's like, here's just an alternate version of what these guys would be like if it was set during the Iraq War as they were set, you know? And it doesn't mean that it has to overwrite or be the definitive. It just means that you've got two ways to enjoy these characters that you enjoy.
Well, that's it. I mean, I'm looking at my collection. One version of something that I thought was brilliant was the animated Flash Gordon. I don't know if you remember that, the old Filmation one, which no. adapted the comics, the original news strips, and did a beautiful job. And it was very authentic, and you looked forward to seeing how they were going to integrate everyone. As you say, Marvel and DC do it all the time. I mean, there's so many people, and I don't understand why, are massively captivated now in Arrow, Flash, stroke Legends of Tomorrow, as people were in Smallville. Or, you know, Gotham is an example. You know, we're very used to sort of adapting one media to another and accepting both media forms and sort of saying, yeah, I can enjoy The Flash and watch the cartoon and read the comic and not feel a tension there.
But unless, reboots, of course, you get something like the new Ghostbusters movie with a female cast and everybody for some reason loses their mind, you know, and it's like, hey, if it's even within the same continuity, it's just like Ghostbusters 2.0. The other guys retired, these ones are moving in. And if it's not within the same continuity, guess what? This is just how it is for this movie. Like, that's fine. You know, this is Ghostbusters for somebody else if it's not for you. You know what I mean? And that's the same way it would be with this Doctor Who, or the same way if when the comic books reboot Spider-Man. You know, it's just like, hey, guess what?
My issue with Ghostbusters, as I think a lot of people's is not the fact that it's women. It's not the fact that it's a reboot. It's just the fact that trailers have not looked very good. And that after 20 years is a big disappointment. But I agree with you.
That's how it's
you don't have to watch it.
Reboots, yeah.
And if you don't watch it, you've made your, as a consumer, your point being made.
Yeah.
I think there's loads. I mean, obviously, it's a hit and miss affair doing reboots, and some of them work, some of them don't. But you don't have to watch them. And I think Doctor Who has got such a rich sense of material. It's a difficult one, isn't it? It's like with the Star Trek, isn't it, with the original series compared to the new films. And I've never been very keen on the new films because I don't feel they adopted what worked in the original is my issue. It's not the fact it's different actors, it's not the fact
Absolutely.
That it's a different, it doesn't feel 60s, it doesn't have to feel 60s, but that sort of trilumative of Spock, McCoy and Kirk just didn't work. So I think if you did a reboot of Doctor Who and you didn't manage to get the Doctor, Ian Chesterton and Barbara working, for me, I think that would probably be the core.
That is something I usually always talk about with films and TV shows. If I like the characters and the concept, I can pretty much get behind what's going on within the story. And the new Star Trek films for me, while I do, I do enjoy them. You know, they're a fun time to go watch at the movies, but I don't, you know, whenever I want to watch something Star Trek, it's always the originals or Next Generation for me, you know? I think what they missed more so was what Star Trek stood for. And I think that's a very key thing to capture, you know, the fact that they were kind of teaching us life lessons and using social kind of aspects of the world that we should be paying attention to. They weren't action flicks, and they could have action, but you needed to have that mirror for reality that we live in, that we should be learning from kind of thing, that social acceptance and so on, that Gene Roddenberry did so well with the original Star Trek. And I think that's kind of what they've lost. They've turned it from what it was into just another action franchise. And if Doctor Who were able to reboot and capture what it did so well with its characters, obviously that would be great. You know, the one thing too I always talk about with science fiction, like, look at this story here. Look at these characters with their big wigs and their, you know, I don't know, those huge collars or shoulder armor, whatever they're wearing. Like, you didn't get a lot of this in other science fiction TV shows. Like, Doctor Who wasn't afraid to say, this may look ridiculous, but this is what these aliens wear. You know, and I loved that. And I would be afraid to see that go. And as we said already about the new series, we miss that so much when you land somewhere and people just dress like humans.
Yeah, there's a lot of guts in this era. And a lot of guts coming from the fact that there wasn't the time, the money, or the... there wasn't that much science fiction going on at that sort of level for you to draw from. While obviously nowadays Doctor Who can see many science fictions done at the same sort of budget level, which they can draw ideas from how to make something look good at that sort of level, what wouldn't look good at that sort of level. You know, Doctor Who was very much on its limb on this sort of story. They were having to sort of guess their way through what would look okay.
Sure.
And I think that, as you say, creates a very exciting and risky aesthetic, which sometimes works and very often doesn't. But it is fascinating to see how it forms. But it's, to me, what makes things like Doctor Who good before this was this. I mean, we've got this moment, this scene, the moment between Barbara, Ian, Vicky and the Doctor arguing about where they were, what they're going to do now. And to me, this was very much what the original Doctor Who was all about, was these scenes. And by this point, as you say, because we start getting the Revolution storylines rolling in that split the companions up quite significantly, you lose that sort of unity.
Yeah,
it's so interesting.
It is. I mean, like, they do like to split the companion and the Doctor, even in these older stories. But these moments where they are all together, I think that's one of the reasons why, like, when you and I have talked before that we enjoy a good TARDIS interior scene. But I think that's probably why I enjoy the TARDIS interior scenes, is because when you got these moments between all the characters before they got split up, you know, I don't know. There's something enjoyable about that, watching them sort it all out, or even just watching them be friendly with each other.
Well, I think my favorite, First Doctor ones tend to be obviously like the Daleks and the Unearthly Child, Keys of Marinus. I think yes. Planet of the Giants is really good, because again it is just essentially the four of them, and it's a really enjoyable to see that interaction. So I think stories where you get that, which are those early ones, you do. By the time when Vicky comes in, they do start splitting them up, I think, more constantly.
Yeah. Planet of the Giants is a really good one, because that's kind of like Space Museum episode one for the entire story.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of how I think the Space Museum would have benefited. But like I said, I mean, this is all still fun. It's
wow. Wait, can you imagine that, though, taking the concept of Space Museum episode one for an entire story where the characters are out of sync with everybody in the story, like telling an entire adventure where the characters affect the lives of the people around them, but nobody has any clue that they're doing it because they're out of phase. Like, they can still, let's say, they can manipulate that world, they can help, but all they can do is hide in the shadows and make changes to their lives. That would be an incredible story. That, as a matter of fact, if they were to do that reboot of Doctor Who that we were talking about, that would be an amazing way to tell this adventure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the sort of thing a reboot could do, is stories like this, which have the potential, almost feel like a draft of something really good, that obviously they just didn't have the time to really nail down. You could do... I think the problem is,
there
of course...
You go. The problem that caused all the dimensional trouble.
I love in these old episodes the way that the reasons would be something like the fluid link or a switch has been caught, the spring in the turn switch. Or, you know, beautiful.
A spring. It's an alien machine and they've got a spring that causes all the issues. That's so great. What is this one? Did he even say what it was?
He says it's a dimensional.
So this thing clicked itself. Dimensional what now, sorry?
Yeah, he said it was a dimensional something or other, I'm sure.
I gotcha.
People who are actual Doctor Who fans will know what we don't. It's great that. It's
this too. I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you. And now they just turned it. But when the scene goes back to the TARDIS, it's one of the things I like about this era, that they've got that foil insert to the inside of the TARDIS rather than just blackness. That somehow, I don't know if they were trying to emulate what the interior of the TARDIS looked like. That foil. It's just like tinfoil.
That's very unusual. They don't normally have that in there, do they?
No, but I like that because it just gives us a sense that, like, if it's not meant to reflect what the actual interior looks like, to me, it reinforces the idea that there was, like, a passageway between the two doorways.
I used to like that idea as a kid. I must say one more thing. I will say, I think the backdrop is very smart here. Those angles on the backdrop means you cannot work out the shape in black and white.
Yes.
It's a great texture. The way I always used to see it in the end was that it never matched up because it was a dimensional anomaly. So, you know, you walked out of, these massive doors and you'd see everything, but you would then suddenly find yourself coming out. You'd look back in, it'd just be a black interior of a police box until you walk in and there's, there's just a total disparity of reality.
I agree.
I think that's the only way that you can reconcile. But I loved it. I still love it more than the Cushing and New Series approach of the doors being a direct relationship.
I agree. I mean, I get what they're doing in the new series, not just because they had the technology to do it. I get that they were trying to do that because they wanted the audience to literally see that this interior was inside that police box. And I'm okay with that. But there was something about this that was a little bit more magical because, I mean, there's plenty of scenes. Go to a Pertwee era, and I'm trying to remember which one it was. I think it might have been the Three Doctors, where the doors are just open in the background and you see it's just a black box inside.
Yeah.
You know? And to me, that's great because it's just one more step in the camouflage of the TARDIS to look like what it's supposed to look like. You know, people just look in, they see a black box. When you walk in, you're kind of phased into where this box is. The interior is.
We've got to say, because we've got this epilogue, which is unusual.
Yeah.
Which is the Daleks leading into the chase. And I just love those control panels, which have been, I assume slaves have made them, and they've made them as cruelly as possible because they've got tiny little thumb switches.
And they're too high up for the little suckers to reach.
See them there? There's no way they could reach them. No way they could see them. One of them looks like they've just been drawn on with pen. So they've obviously, the slaves have a real grudge against the Daleks, but... No, so yeah, it's a brilliant story. I apologise to anyone who thought that we'd be talking so much more specifically, but in the end, we are aware that there's a lot of people who'll be listening to these podcasts who have not got access to the DVDs, and some of the wider discursive stuff around them, I think, is kind of interesting. I still enjoy it. I think it's a good episode. It's
This is one of my favourites. I always talk about the Keys of Marinus, but this is one of my go-to episodes. I really like this one a lot.
Yes, it's a sort of a gentle, I don't know, but yet slightly thoughtful element to this, which especially is unusual for the series of the time. You don't normally get them dealing with time in such a way. So especially for this era, it stands out.
Yeah.
That's great, great stuff. Have you got anything more to add on that you think...
The only thing I can think to say is I know we both had said something like we'd like to see them deal with that issue from episode one a little bit more, and remembering that it was basically the crux of their whole journey throughout the rest of the story was good, but I do agree it would have been interesting to have seen that idea played with a while longer. I mean, like I said, even it probably, if they were to do it a little while longer, they probably would have expanded it to like two episodes and then had the Doctor in it, because you can't leave an episode where the Doctor affects the characters' lives without the characters thanking the Doctor in this era, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But to me, it would have been so neat if they just affected their lives and left, and these people just thought they won their revolution all on their own. You know,
but then you did get that in Planet of the Giants, didn't you?
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely.
So it wasn't totally rare for them to do that. And I think, you know, when we were talking about it at the beginning of this episode of the story, I think that was probably what was resonating with me was Planet of the Giants, and thinking this could, as you said, especially as you said, you know, you have it where they're totally out of sync with the characters for the next episode as they try and prevent stuff from happening, and they can affect the world, but not in the right temporal synchronicity. So it's sort of like a dual synchronicity. Sort of diachronic, I suppose the word would be kind of interesting.
Diachronic.
Yeah,
nice.
Absolutely. I know. I thought you'd like that.
Yeah.
The synchronic and the
on
diachronic.
Right there, teaching us something here.
Absolutely.
What?
Yeah. Going into semiotics of all sorts. Yeah. No. It's a good story, and if you've not seen it, I would recommend you having a watch. It's there's a couple in there's only a couple in the William Hartnell era which I think from a science fiction point of view are kind of out of sync with the rest of it, and that is one of them. I would say the Ark is another, which
yeah.
does something which is very unusual to the era. So if you know you're looking to sort of try and show off some of the odd stuff of William Hartnell, Space Museum I think is definitely one to go for.
Yeah,
I think Keys Marinus is still my favorite, but
yeah, oh no, I completely agree. Keys of Marinus just has everything for me in that particular story. But as we said before, if you're one of those ones that that are, you know, you're listening and you're not able to watch along, hopefully, obviously, you didn't get all the key points that we had, but hopefully you enjoyed what we were talking about as we went along. But if you are some of the few that threw the DVD on with us, I'm very curious to hear your thoughts. I mean, I know we deviated quite a lot, but still very curious to hear how the commentary worked with you as you tracked along with the episodes. So if feel free, drop us a line. If not, hey, no worries. You know, if you're enjoying it, it's all that matters.
Because the problem is with doing these DVD commentaries, especially when you've got people watching alongside us with the commentary, you've got to say, if we end up talking too much about the show, they might as well just switch on to the DVD commentary and listen
sure.
to the people involved in the show talk about it, because they're probably going to be a little more informed than we are. So speaking broader seems to make sense from that sort of angle as well. So anyway, so I think we're done for this week,
yeah.
or this week's, depending on whether Christian splits this up or not. You will know more than we do on that factor, because I'll be up to him to decide. And we'll be back again in some formation of the three of us, or maybe four of us. If we get I'd love to get Gareth back to do one, to be honest.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
See if we can get Gareth to come back and challenge him on one that he hates. Really
I like cool. the challenge ones, actually. We need to do another challenge one.
Yeah, we're being a little safe, haven't we? We've picked ones that we like rather than ones that we don't. And maybe next time, when it's the two of us, certainly, we will try and pick one that we both don't particularly connect with.
That would be, yeah, I'm in.
Cool, we're in on that.
Okay. So now they know what to expect.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys for listening, and we will talk to you soon.